I suggest we resume our deliberations, and we are going to talk about rate-regulated activities. And I give the floor to Mariela.
Thank you, Hans. Good afternoon. The purpose of this session is to seek advice from the AESA members on our initial views on disclosure objectives and disclosure requirements for defined rate regulation. We have prepared four papers. The main paper that I would like to discuss with you is Agenda Paper 4B. The other three papers are provided for context, but we are happy to answer any questions on them if you have any. It's worth mentioning, though, that in Agenda Paper 4A, we provide a reminder of how the rate adjustment mechanism within the regulatory agreement results in regulatory timing differences that create enforceable rights and enforceable obligations. We've previously discussed how the resulting regulatory assets and regulatory liabilities are originated and reversed, recovered, or fulfilled, and how they affect then the cash flows of the entity. This paper also includes all of the tentative decisions made by the board to date. As you have seen in the papers, the next step in the project is to discuss disclosures to help users understand the effects of those timing differences on the entity's financial performance and financial position, and we are seeking your input before discussing this topic with the board. So starting now with paper 4B, as you have seen, this paper makes reference to the board's current discussion on its project disclosure initiative, targeted standards level review of disclosures. This project aims to develop guidance for the board to use when developing and drafting disclosure objectives and requirements. We are looking to use this developing guidance where we think it's helpful, and at the same time, we also aim to share our experiences when developing disclosure objectives and requirements for defined regulation with the disclosure initiative team. The guidance that they are developing suggests identifying an overall disclosure objective that is supported by more granular specific disclosure objectives. In addition, an entity also needs to consider the disclosures in the context of the financial statements as a whole, per the conceptual framework and IS1. And we have precisely done so. So we have also considered the overarching objectives in the conceptual framework and in IS1. And when doing so, we think that the disclosure objectives and requirements for defining regulation should focus on the effects that transactions or events that give rise to the timing differences have on an entity's financial performance and financial position. And at this point, we think it is relevant for us to stress that the satisfaction of the disclosure objectives is a mandatory requirement on its own. So an entity shall give information to fulfill these objectives. Satisfaction of the disclosure objectives, then, is not optional, it's a requirement itself. An additional matter that we would like to discuss and stress with you is that you might have noted that the style, the way we have drafted the disclosure requirements in paragraphs 34 to 38 of the paper, we are using a less prescriptive language there. This is to let you know that the board has yet to make decisions about how prescriptive the language in the disclosure requirements should be. So at this time, please do not be distracted by the way we have worded the disclosure requirements in the paper. We are most interested in whether we have captured the right sort of information to disclose. You might have seen as well that in the last 10 paragraphs of the paper, we are illustrating some of the disclosure requirements by using a case study that describes the origination and reversal of timing differences. And the background information of that case study is in paper 4C. And the last point that we'd like to highlight is that the board has not discussed yet presentation requirements in terms of the number and location of the line items in the primary financial statements. This means that the illustrative disclosures that we have in the paper assume the minimum number of line items that we are likely to recommend the board as outlined in paragraph 6 of this paper. And with that, we can start the discussions. We have prepared 6 questions. You have all of the questions in the cover note in paper 4. We are quite flexible in the way you'd like to provide us your feedback. We would maybe have a preference in having your feedback split in the same way we have the questions in the cover note. But as said, if you prefer to give your feedback at once, it's also an option for us. Thank you very much.
They can be flexible as long as they meet the objectives.
Yes, thank you. I have a question before we get into the details of the discussions. On page 14, or Appendix B of paper 4A, you show the next steps of the project plan. And it seems like you will be discussing consequential amendments and then whether you issue a discussion paper or exposure draft. And we had the impression that if you're discussing consequential amendments, you wouldn't really go into a discussion paper, you go directly to an exposure draft. So it seems like you already made your decision on that. Well, at least the staff has made the decision on it. So can you try to explain why?
Yeah. Well, for the first few months of this year, we were writing papers not knowing whether we were going to an exposure draft or a discussion paper, which actually made it very difficult to write the papers in a focused way. So we agreed with the board that we would write papers as though we were going to go for an exposure draft to see how far we could go, and then revisit that. If we felt that we could go to an exposure draft, we would keep going. If not, we could revert to a different style of paper for the board. So you're quite right. We feel at the moment as though we're on track to go to an exposure draft, but we've still got things to consider. So the consequential amendments, you're quite right. If we feel that we're not getting as far as an ED, we may take that out and discuss it at a later date.
Tricia.
Okay, we are generally supportive about the direction. Let's be very clear about that. So when I'm going to be fairly nitpicky, it's in the context of overall support. And we didn't have a lot of time to discuss it us in our usual meeting of our consultative forum, but we've been doing some internal discussion since then. And so question one, generally, you know, overall supportive. What I'd like to do is jump to questions 5 and 6. And if you go through those illustrative examples, which without going to paper 4C, which tells you what the answer is, and you say, I'm a user and I'm looking at the information in 4B because that's what I've got, you simply don't have enough information to know what's going on. So I think my major concern is that the objectives are broadly fine. I think you can do some fine-tuning on the wording because you say you should consider disclosing something that the disclosure objective says you must disclose. I mean, let's not go there. But I don't think that I understood without reading paper 4C where those assets came from, the regulatory assets, where the liabilities came from, what caused them, and enough about my expectations of what was going to happen. So to me, that was the first problem. Is I think also your next problem is that you've got some suggestions you'd be relying on reportable segments. I think many companies would see this as a single reportable segment, or in some cases, when we've looked at real companies, it's not a reportable segment at all. And particularly if you're horizontally integrated, so like electricity, you generate, you transmit, you retail, it's possibly only the transmission part that's rate regulated. I don't know that you would find enough about that by relying on things like reportable segments. And so it was much more about what's really happening behind the numbers, that I think your objectives are right, but your outcomes don't get you there.
Linda.
Can I just ask Patricia a quick question about her comment? You know, your first comment about the specific disclosures outlined in the paper won't give you enough information to know what's going on. If you look, for example, at if you look at paragraph 34, 35, 36, fine, and then at the at the illustrative disclosures that result, does this mean that you would write additional disclosure requirements or more requirements for general context as a disclosure?
I think the problem is context. You know how the numbers are moving, but you don't know what's causing the numbers. So you don't know enough about, is it a volume variant? Is it a bonus for good performance? You just don't know what's coming from. So I think it's the qualitative that's missing, not the quantitative.
Sven? Oh, sorry, Linda.
Okay. Yeah, I was just waiting for him to catch up. I knew he'd get there. So first I wanted just to mention for everybody's information that we have finalized our research paper, and it's in translation now. And we expect to post it publicly within the next... Where's Rebecca?
Sure.
30 to 45 days?
Sounds about right.
Thank you. So we'll let everybody know when we do that. But so it's an updated version of the research paper that you've seen, and we thank those who are able to give us submissions. So overall, and it won't be surprising, we support both the specific disclosure objectives as well as the overall disclosure objective. On the specific one, it seems to us, based on our experiences, what you're doing there is helping the users understand the effects of the rate-regulated activities and helping them understand what the future cash flows are going to look like. In terms of the overall disclosure objective, you're helping them understand things like the origination and reversal of the regulatory timing differences and the effects of those transactions. You know, that's our reading of that, so we're generally supportive. And this is where now I go, however, okay? We do know that you, especially when you look at paragraph 19, I think of 4B, you talk about not disclosing the overall risks and uncertainties kind of that the entity is dealing with. And in our mind, especially because we're observing transactions where, for instance, a Canadian entity is buying a U.S. entity, and they're buying U.S. entities perhaps in one area of the U.S. and a completely different area of the U.S., and you're operating under multiple different regulatory environments. And so it's not clear to us why that kind of risk and uncertainty is anything different than the risk and uncertainty, for instance, under IFRS 7. So we'd like you to think about that. Now, when you actually look at what you've written in 35B, you kind of suggest that you're getting there. And so, in effect, maybe what you want to do is clarify what you mean in terms of we're not going to do that, because you do talk about risks and uncertainty in 35B. So just, you might want to clarify that. Our User Advisory Council has indicated to us that they think this particular issue is one of the most important ones, because that information, in addition to when the last time there was a regulatory review, is one of the most important things they look at. Because the regulatory review, the regulator goes in and looks at the regulatory filings and how the entity has actually accumulated the costs for the regulatory filings and says, yeah, you're good to go. And it's almost like a sign-off, and then they don't do it for a number of years. So that information is important to the users because it's like a bill of good health based on where they've been, so then they look at the future cash flows with more certainty in their minds. So you might want to consider that. Mm-hmm. In terms of, as well, what our users are telling us with regard to their experience with 14, they're actually quite positive about the disclosures that resulted from IFRS 14, those types of disclosures like the reconciliation, et cetera. And so the one thing they've said is they've had some difficulty understanding the net movements in OCI. So you might want to take a look at that and clarifying that guidance, because they're having difficulty. The entities are having some difficulty doing it, and the users are having difficulty doing it. The last thing our user advisor council told us is that they would like to know, and they see now in most companies, is the disclosure of the regulatory asset base compared to the assets on the financial statement, because there are things they can include in the regulatory asset base, like costs that they might have expensed, they can include in the regulatory filings in the asset base. And so they provide a reconciliation between that and the stuff that's on the balance sheet. But overall, I think you're headed in the right direction and you've made great progress and we're supportive of the activities.
Cédric.
Thank you, Hans. Well, France is very supportive of the project, and I think many people in France are expecting...
Wait, you'll need to be louder.
Sorry. Okay. Sorry. Yeah. Are expecting an exposure draft in the future. So we are very positive. But I must admit that some of the provision in the future standard are not very clear to us, and that's there are some areas where we would like to have some clarification. And I think the examples that you provided in 4C is helping in understanding the way you present and you measure the adjustment. Maybe the major question that we have to date is that we understand that the purpose of the rate regulated activity here is to of the provisions that you suggest is to adjust the P&L. So it's first of all an adjustment in the performance statement. And in that regard, the adjustment in the balance sheet is rather a consequence of the adjustment in the performance. If I take an example where you may have a different kind of adjustment in a regulation, some of them are purely qualitative, some of them are based on OPEX, some of them are based on CAPEX. If you have, I think our understanding is that the accounting treatment that you suggest here is very close to the one that we have under IS 12, if I make the comparison, because you calculate temporary differences between the regulation and the IFRS financial statement. And if I take the example of an adjustment which would be on the OPEX, that means that the regulation will adjust the margin based on standards margin, accepting some costs and rejecting some other. Let's assume that the adjustment would accept the change in pension costs based on a cash basis instead of an accrual basis. We are concerned that the adjustment, or we think that the adjustment should be calculated only on the OPEX difference in the P&L, but we are struggling whether in the suggestions that you make here, you would not calculate beyond the cost the basis that would be on the balance sheet, meaning that you would calculate the difference in the accrual on the cash and accrual basis of the provision for pension. And among that basis, you would calculate what is the permanent, what is the temporary difference, and record the adjustment only on the temporary difference. And we are a bit concerned that if we go in this direction, it would come to a very complex analysis, which may be also very volatile because some agreements are only for a couple of years. So there is no necessarily plan to absorb all the provisions that is in the balance sheet. So we would like to make sure that our understanding of the adjustment would only be calculated on the P&L adjustment and not on any hypothetical basis which would compare a kind of balance sheet regulation, regulatory balance sheet with a regulatory IFRS, with an IFRS balance sheet.
Okay. Shall I have a go and then you do it that way? I mean, I think there are some of these timing differences that we've talked about that are very straightforward and simple and very clear. There are some that we don't think should be picked up by the model at all, which are more kind of structural type things like inflationary uplifts of capital items, PP&E, etc., which we think do fall outside because they are not timing differences that are affecting the profit and loss account going through. There are some that drop in the middle where there is a question as to whether it is a timing difference as we're trying to define it or whether it is, as you say, a permanent difference. And at this stage, the board haven't drilled down into the detail of all of these types of adjustments. It's something that we do need to do a little bit more work around to clarify that sort of thing. What we're certainly not looking to do is try and do a full-blown reconciliation with every line item in the balance sheet to the line items in the regulatory balance sheet. The purpose of the model is not to effectively get to the full-blown regulatory accounting, but our ambition, I think, is a bit bigger than just picking up the short-term timing differences that are included in the next rate adjustment. We're looking at the whole regulatory agreement.
Mary, did you want to add?
If I just build on what Jane has said, I think, Cedric, your point, first of all, makes me pleased about the disclosure outline, because what you're saying is looking at the disclosure made you get insights into the accounting model and ask questions about the accounting model, which is a good thing if thinking about disclosure has that effect. So that's good. In terms of the question that you ask, I absolutely agree with everything Jane said. I just want to make sure that people don't pick up the point she said about the board hasn't talked through some of these that may be in a bit of a gray area. If I stick with your pension example, if, let's say, a regulator allows pension expense on a cash basis but not an accrual basis, not the IAS 19 basis, that means that assuming that all of the pension plan relates to rate-regulated activities, that may not be true, and I think that's part of what Jane was talking about when she said we don't mean a full-blown reconciliation of the entire balance sheet. But if you assume for a moment that the pension obligation relates solely to rate-regulated activities and that all of it would be considered, on a cash basis to be allowed, then I think the cumulative liability that you have on your balance sheet would have to be a source of a timing difference just over a very long horizon, that is considered in recognition of your regulatory assets. Now, you'd have to put it through the measurement uncertainty and the other recognition criteria that we built out, but you would have to consider that. But I think it's a very good challenge to us to look, make sure that we're illustrating when we come to, illustrating the proposals in whatever the next consultation document is, that we make clear its consideration of not only adjusting the statement of performance, but also thinking about cumulative differences that build up over many years' performance. Presumably, in an entity with this kind of pension, cumulative pension obligation, you've looked each year at the difference between the IAS 19 expense and what's allowed for regulatory purposes and built that up year by year. So I think we do, as Jane said, need to do more work on it, but I think it's more to illustrate how the principles we've already tentatively agreed on apply rather than to consider whether they need a different treatment.
Thanks, Mary. That's helpful. Yeah.
Okay, I passed. That's good.
As a better way of explaining than that. Yeah.
Sven.
So I guess we're basically covering all fixed questions as one. So probably just starting with one general observation. I think this element of uncertainty kicks in quite often in the disclosure. So we have uncertainty, estimates, regulatory and demand risks in I was thinking, is this, let's say, well balanced with the overall scope of the project? So I thought that we have quite, let's say, strict recognition and measurement principles to reduce this sort of risk, to have some sort of revenue adjustment which are not basically recoverable in the future. So I thought that I think you should be careful that this isn't giving out the message, well, you can basically recognize everything unless you have proper disclosure. I think that's not the idea. The idea is start with the definition and the recognition requirement, and then basically get, let's say, some sort of additional service. If there are any risk remaining, we are also disclosing them. So I think that should be very, very clear in the objective of these disclosures. On the individual question, probably two things, which I think are worth mentioning. One is on the second objective, on the timing, so basically the first two questions you raised. I was thinking, well, basically, this is already an issue which starts with the measurement, and that is how does this time value of money concept really works for deferrals or prepayments? So can you really adjust or reconcile these future recovery for this type of prepayments? Probably we should leave that to the wisdom of the industry if they can do that, but what I have in mind is the general discussion we have with IAS 12 and temporary differences and not discounting them and all this type of thing. So I was thinking probably that's also worth considering here, what were some of the arguments pro and con there. What I think is important, that this is, let's say, in line with the measurement idea. So if we have a measurement idea, then of course this type of disclosure should be derived on under the very same principles, I would say. And the second comment is on, well, question three, on this level of disaggregation on estimates. I think how you've drafted the papers and in your example, you're indeed talking about accounting estimates. And I was thinking, well, there are probably also a lot of estimates in these regulatory models themselves. So there are also estimates coming in from the authorities. And they are indeed the ones which are causing the whole issue coming up, that there is some uncertainty in estimates, and then this is causing this sort of regulatory assets and liabilities. I assume that you're not trying to cover this with this type of estimates. I think these are really the, let's say, management judgment or the estimate the company makes. So probably that is worth clarifying a little bit, that these authorities' estimates or estimates which are part of the model are, I would say, part of the fact pattern. I think you should not just come around them with some simple disclosures. Yeah. So otherwise, I would say it's very, very, very good paper, very good illustration of some of the disclosures and the ideas. So I found it very, very helpful to see these examples. What is your proposed outcome?
Thank you. Naomi.
Thank you, Hans. We have received several comments from AOSSD working group members. And regarding the disclosure objective, one member mentioned that the disclosure objective should cover the information about the regulatory environment because it would be useful to understand the regulated operation and the financial result with regard to the regulated operation. And as for the question of the level of disaggregation of disclosure, members which provided comments broadly agreed with the proposal. And lastly, regarding the disclosure requirements, one member which provided comments generally agreed with the proposal, but also noted its concerns on the potential overlap between the disclosures required by the standard for rate-regulated activities and required by other standards such as IFRS 15. Thank you.
Alexandru.
We've been talking about this paper for some time. It's really good. One element that I like to add here is regarding the disclosure. Despite the fact that I believe that this high level disclosure objective, it's obviously the right approach to it. Rate regulated activities is actually an umbrella for a lot of things, very different things. And see this example here on 4C. Is pretty much clear what accounting means, one, because we know the context. Okay? But then you have all of the forms of rate-regulated activities. For example, if you think about energy, for example, in Brazil, you have one kind of regulator for general energy and have another kind of regulation for renewables. And if you are doing renewable, you have access to cheaper capital, you have access to a lot of different things. So I believe in this case, we should should be mandatory to give more details about not only the regulatory environment regulation, but about the contract, what the contract entails to you. Because it's pretty much clear what the numbers are in this specific time period here that we are, you are showing expenses, et cetera. But what that entails for the future is, do you have to return the asset? Which conditions do you have to return the asset? What if you don't return the asset? How does that work? So I believe the broader disclosure here should be mandatory. Otherwise, you can reach very, very incorrect conclusions about the economics behind these agreements. Agreements, we just take a look at so many agreements, you know, hundreds of kinds of agreements in the same sector, because from time to time, so they last for 20 years, they have every few years they change the agreement, so you have some companies have at the same time 4 or 5 different agreements in the same taking place at the same time, you know, despite being the same sector. So it's complicated here. I didn't know that is the example that I saw. There was this company that had 4 different agreements, because over time the agreements changed, because the government changed it. So they have 4 different agreements at the same time. So the numbers are actually a basket of different agreements.
Can I just maybe sort of pick up on the point there? We've talked to some users as well, talking about, I think, what they're used to getting, and I think Linda touched on this as well, and a couple of others, about the background information about the regulatory environment, and certainly in IFRS 14, which was really based on what people were doing in practice, that there's a request there for some background information. But
sorry, the reason I mentioned contract and not regulatory environment, because in that specific case, there was such an unregulatory environment today. But what this company has is a different contract, because one contract was signed 10 years ago on a different regulatory environment. Then have a different regulatory environment today, and they have both things accruing. So expenses and from different. So regulatory environment broadly conceived, it includes past, if relevant, regulatory environment. So, sorry.
And I don't think that will be totally uncommon. Things do change, and you sign contracts or you start work in different times. But we need to consider this really, I think, in the context of what we're recognising and measuring in the financial statement should already reflect the economics of those contracts and regulatory agreements, as it does for anything else in the financial statement. So, for example, you may have provisions for environmental liabilities, for, you know, rehabilitation and things like that, and we don't sort of see a detail of the regulatory environment that's driving that, similarly for emissions and things. It's something that I think is coming into the more comprehensive, wider corporate reporting environment and the integrated reporting.
Yeah, but in that specific case, let me give you the example, maybe more clear. It's the company that does work with a large... the privatized, the huge project privatization roads in the country. So we take one road, one interstate road. There is one kind of contract, and that means one thing. And the same company has, at the same time, another contract for another road. That's completely different.
Mm-mm.
When you look at the numbers, you're going to be both together. If you don't explain that exactly how they are decomposed, that's going to be, if you try to understand the mix, you're actually not understanding anything. Because one will have to return it, the other one has to keep some maintenance costs, the other one doesn't have any maintenance costs. One is inflation adjusted, the other one is not inflation adjusted, and so on and so forth.
If I may just on this, I think the same thinking would apply at the consolidated level, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because they are operating various different countries and with different, so the same thing, I think we can take this as take into consideration the rights and obligations that would derive from the contracts in various jurisdictions that the company is operating. Because we tend to think about we are operating here and doing only this, and they are not alike. Yeah,
a large construction company operating different countries. Now, different contracts in the same country and in different countries.
Yeah.
Alessandra, the entity of your example, do you think that that entity could solve this issue by lowering down the level of aggregation that it provides in the disclosures? For example, if it concluded that for them those timing differences have different maturity profiles and they are different and they would warrant specific disclosures,
yeah.
Wouldn't that be solved by the entity assessing that the level of aggregation that needed to be provided is at that level of a contract, for example?
No, you're absolutely right. And my question here, should we leave it to voluntary disclosure? Right. Because, of course, you can voluntarily can do anything you want. But a question is, should we leave it to voluntary disclosure? Should we require some, of course, if material,
yeah,
some level of specificity? Because especially those construction contractors, they operate across the region. They operate in different countries also. Yeah.
So this is exactly a question for you, actually.
Yes.
This is actually.
I'm commenting on all of them.
Could I ask Alexandra a question about what you were just saying? And I'm just trying to understand the consequences of this point about, let's say, four different contracts with the same regulator for the same activity, just over different periods of time.
Or different regulators, maybe.
Or maybe different. Is the effect that you want qualitative disclosures about the key terms and conditions of each contract, or are you saying that when you look at the quantitative disclosures that are provided, you want to require rather than encourage somebody to separate the quantitative disclosures by different contracts, if significantly different, or both?
Yeah, I'll give you my view because I haven't discussed those two options with my jurisdiction. But what I know that analysts, mm-hmm, sell-side analysts, do for a fact is that they split it.
The numbers.
They say like some sort of segment reporting. They do, instead of segment, they do a contract report. This is contract like A, this contract like B, contract like C, and they forecast cash flows different from each contract. And so how that works? They ask company for separate information. They say, give me the terms of that contract, the terms of that contract. So that's why most of them say the accounting for this sector is pretty much useless, because they cannot rely on the accounting because it's too aggregated. Okay,
they said, you can get some of this from the regulatory filings also,
yeah,
if they're public.
Yes. Anything on the public, some companies release that as a separate spreadsheet, for example.
Yeah.
They put on a separate spreadsheet on their website, say, oh, this is contract, this is my number, this is 100, but this 100 is split, or sometimes they put on the MD&A, or there are different views of that. But it's very hard to forecast cash flows based on the accounting information when they mix so many different structure. So my just personal view, I would think that some quantitative
disaggregation
would be helpful if material. Maybe a general comment, a general prescription. If a material, when that's relevant information, should be split.
Well, and I think what you're pointing to is if you're operating under agreements that have significantly different terms in terms of margins and impacts on future cash flows,
yeah,
then disaggregate the quantitative information so that you can see the different margin,
yeah,
and impacts on future cash flows.
One example that I can give you is if you're doing renewable energy, you have this contract, and that contract gives you cheaper funding also. Mm-hmm. So the whole package, you not only build the renewable, but you access to cheaper funding. So if the company is doing more of these, it's much better than doing more of the other one. It doesn't have access to cheaper funding. So analysts like to have that split because they want to see the results of this cheaper funding scheme, not the whole thing together. Because at the end of the day, you reach an average of the average cost of capital because they are completely different arrangements.
Kimberly?
I guess similar to some of the previous comments, while recognising you don't want to have a lot of general stuff about the general regulatory environment and economic environment, it did feel like you went to the opposite extreme and went very narrow in terms of the objective, and it did feel like you at least needed some contextual information about, so I was looking at, you know, IFRS's 14 disclosures, where it has a brief description of the nature and extent of the rate-regulated activity and the nature of the regulatory setting process. I think you do need some contextual information for these timing differences. And to respond to the reasons why you didn't want to do that, saying, oh, it's broader, et cetera, I think it's important to remember that you're only recognising pieces of the regulatory agreement, deliberately recognising pieces of the regulatory agreement. So there are missing things from the financial statements, and I'm not suggesting you should put those in, but so one example might be, say, during the year you've incurred some costs and now you're recognising this regulatory asset. But at the same time, there's been a regulatory review that's actually required you to decrease your general rate. It's had gone down as a consequence of a general regulatory review. So you've had some good news and bad news, if you like, during the year. This will only give you the good news and not the rest of it. So I think, at the very least, I think you do need to think of at least some qualitative information to give people some context before you go right into the specifics of the timing differences. In terms of the specific the disclosure objectives, I thought the overall disclosure objective, I know you're still working on the drafting, but I encourage you to think about really what are you focusing on here, because I noticed that the objective talked about both financial performance and financial position. The explanation underneath it, to me, seemed to be more focused on financial performance rather than financial position. And when I thought about, well, which of those do I think is the right focus? I think given the objectives of this project, it does seem to be about financial performance rather than financial position. And as I said, given you're recognising the pieces, so maybe it's, you should think about focus on the performance rather than position. In terms of the specific objectives, I guess similar comments apply to that. Most of them seemed okay, apart from thinking about whether you're focusing on performance or financial position. When it got down to the disaggregation, I had similar reactions as Patricia mentioned earlier, that looking at the numbers, you really couldn't tell what was going on. I read paper 4C first of all and noticed that year X0 was quite a bad year. You know, they had this penalty that they incurred. They had some storm damage where they didn't think they were going to be able to get all of those costs allowed, and that was why year zero was worse than all the other years. But when you looked at the quantitative disclosures you were providing, you actually didn't even get that sense. So you didn't really know, because you didn't have information about the nature or type. So maybe that's a bit like IS12, where you do have to break it down by different kinds of timing differences. In particular, when you were saying, and I think it was in paragraph 43B, that if you looked at it, you could see that there was 340 million currency units representing funding received in advance of the service requirements to be fulfilled in the future, but actually 140 of it was relating to the penalty. So it wasn't funding received in advance, it was the penalty. So I think without information about the nature or type of timing difference, I think it's potentially misleading, and it's quite hard to get your head around, well, what do all those numbers mean? So
It's interesting. We had some of that debate internally, and particularly around the penalty. Should it be disclosed separately? That part of that regulatory liability is a penalty. And then we were trying to say, well, if the regulator had have just fined the company, so exactly the same cause of the penalty, but instead of fining them through the rate, they just said, give us a check for this amount of money. What disclosures would we require around that? And at the moment, we couldn't think of any disclosure requirement that would force a company to say, the reason our profit has gone down by this amount is because we got hit with a fine during the year. So what we were trying to do is sort of focus very much on what is the additional information about these timing differences that we think is unique to these situations, and try and, you know, have a level playing field. So irrespective of whether the penalty is a fine or a rate adjustment, what's maybe more important, and this is the reason for asking for feedback, is not the cause of the reduction in the rate, but just the fact that there is a reduction of the rate and it's going to have an impact of this amount for this number of years?
I guess, first of all, I'd think not disclosing that the fact that you've incurred this huge penalty would be... Surely it's got to be useful information, but then if you also...
Yeah, we don't deny it's not useful, but would you expect it if it was a fine?
Yes, yes, I would. And if you look at some of the other breakdowns that we do have when you're doing this type of reconciliation, I can look at the provision standard where you have to break it down by type of provision. I've already mentioned IS 12, where you have to give information about the different types of timing differences. Even PP&E, we have to break it down by class of PP&E to show the movement. So I think this is probably the only example that I've seen of this type of reconciliation. We've got all sorts of lots of things going on and there's no...
And also IS1, I think, requires stuff on compliance with laws and regulations, and presumably a regulatory fine is some form of lack of compliance. So it would come through the general standard, not get locked into this. So I don't think you can use that as a reason for not identifying it separately. Because if it was paid in one go and it's material, it would be identified separately.
And again, we've had the debates about, you know, what's... We've tried to look at this by saying what are the general requirements, which is the same with the objectives. We've done with the requirements as well. So if there's already disclosure requirements in other places, we don't want to be repeating what's required. And we've got a catch-all to say, you know, there are things in IS1 for these stuff, but maybe we need to be more specific with particular types of items, maybe, to point them in the direction of those things.
I mean, I would think the normal person naively would say, well, if I'm doing it under rate regulation new standard and it says I don't need to disclose it, I've now got a specific standard that doesn't tell me to disclose it, which would normally override a general standard which tells me to disclose it. So I think if you've got to be careful about where you rely on general standards when it's explicitly mm-hmm. within the scope of the standard.
Alberto.
Thank you. We have not discussed these papers with our rate regulated stakeholder group, but the initial reaction by the staff or the OIC is that we welcome this disclosure, especially the high-level objectives which prompt the preparers to think of the user's need about this, about their specific business. Having said that, when we discuss, we will discuss with our rate regulator, regulated group, I do expect the usual, because it's composed mainly by preparers, I do expect the usual complaint. disclosure, more disclosure, many disclosure. So we will wait and see if they can justify that some disclosure is not needed because maybe superfluous or the U.S. do not need. We will see. I have a specific doubt or request for clarification. Talking about disaggregation, you also indicate that companies should disclose the discount rate. And they wonder whether this discount rate will be left to the discretion of the preparers, or if you, as standard setter, will give some guidance about this discount rate. I know that there was a project on rationalizing discount rates throughout all the standards where discount rate is required. So I don't know in this case whether you will be keen to consider guidance or even mandatory, I don't know, or just suggestion, which is the best discount rate for these asset and liabilities.
Again, that's something that we've discussed as part of the measurement. And we came up with a phrase that companies should use a reasonable rate, and we still need to build in drafting some more guidance around what's reasonable, but it's mainly going to be driven by the regulatory agreement rather than a free decision of the company. It will be driven by what the rate is that they're allowed by the regulator.
Peter?
So I'd like to make 3 points. First of all, I was very pleased that the very first comment, which was from Patricia, was about looking at the disclosure examples we provided and trying to work out whether the user could understand it. That was exactly what we were trying to achieve. Maybe we feel we didn't quite achieve it, but that was our target, and I think that's the test we wanted to set ourselves, is are we providing information that's going to be useful to the users and they can understand, and not just for techies, by the way. The second is on the point that various people have raised about the disclosures about the regulatory agreement, the general environment, things of that kind. I think there's a very important linkage there with the scope of the standard that's going to result ultimately, because the accounting model at the moment is focused on places where there are timing differences. And the approach that's been taken in the staff paper is to say that the reason we're doing this project is really because these timing differences exist, and if they didn't exist, there wouldn't be a problem that we'd have to solve. And so we're focused on giving the right information about those timing differences. Now, it's true, of course, that the defined rate regulation is going to have a completely pervasive effect on the entity's financial position and performance. It's going to affect every number in the financial statements. It's going to affect the economic activity. But we didn't think it was the objective of this project to try and give that complete picture of every effect the rate regulation has on the entity. If we did decide that was the effect, then I think we'd have to broaden the scope of the project, because otherwise you'd be giving that information just to the people who happen to have timing differences, but not for the people who don't have timing differences, which doesn't really seem to make, well, to us it didn't make sense, so we thought it was better to have the narrow focus. And I think a related point there is, we wondered whether if we want to give that extra information, whether financial statements are really the right place for it, or whether that's more like management commentary. I do take Kimberly's point that you might need a bit, but it would be context for the timing differences rather than a sort of broader analysis of the effects of the regulatory agreements. The third point I wanted to make was about the reconciliations and the level of disaggregation. Now, it's absolutely natural to all of us to think of a disaggregation by type, and, you know, think of the IS-12 analogy or the provisions, and to do it by class and to track those through from cradle to grave. But we tried to focus it much more, and we said we think actually what the users need is the split in the period when they originate, because they need to know what caused the timing differences. But once they've originated, we weren't convinced that it was necessary to track them beyond that. Once they've originated, they're a bit like payables and receivables. They're not exactly payables and receivables, but the thing that caused them originally seemed to us much less important. And so we focused the disclosure there on what happens on the origination, and then looking more at an overall level at the amount, timing and uncertainty of the future effects.
So,
at the risk of treading into words, which I know isn't exactly what you want, but to try and just a few observations when I looked at this, and I should start by saying that I liked overall the approach to thinking about what information was helpful for users of the financial statements, and trying to be more specific about what types of information we were interested in, and to try and use a subjective-based approach. But just looking at the specific disclosure objectives in particular, I thought maybe we could be a little bit more clear in terms of our intent, and maybe make it more helpful for people, particularly if we're going to transition to a sort of trying a new way of drafting our disclosure requirements, if we had a clearer link between sort of first bits of these specific disclosure objectives, which felt relatively generic, and then the second pieces, which was generally a bit more specific. So if I look, for example, at specific disclosure objective one, I think the second paragraph is in this, I think arguably, much more sort of instructive and clear about exactly what it is that we think is interesting for investors. And it wouldn't necessarily be the case if you read the first paragraph and came up with something more generic that you would necessarily meet the objective of that second bit there. So I think it would be probably good to sort of be clear that the information will be useful when it allows, or if it enables users to understand these particular things, to make it a little bit more specific while still keeping the type of language that you're looking for.
A tighter
link between the two pieces. And on disclosure objective three, a similar thing. I think if somebody was either not wanting to understand or really not understanding what we were getting at and they read the first paragraph of that disclosure objective three, they might think that just by saying, you know, the carrying amount changed by 20, they'd met that objective, whereas I think what you're really wanting to get at is more of a disaggregated type of analysis that explains what it is that drove the balance change. And that, and you, and I wouldn't have got that from the first sentence in isolation. So, but maybe linking the two is how you do it, but certainly I think along the right track. But
because that's, I don't know if anybody else failed to pick up, that's looking for a reconciliation of the opening and closing balances and what ties them together.
And if ultimately we're not going to say you have to provide a reconciliation, it needs to be clear that in the disclosure objective we need to understand the information that might normally come from the type of reconciliation.
Okay. Does that bring us to the end of the discussion?
Okay.
I believe so.
Thank you very much.
Shall we have a 15-minute break?
Thank you.